To Joshua, God said this, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not already commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened, and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. These were God's words to Joshua shortly after he became the new chosen leader of God's people, Israel. For some 40 years, of course, Moses had been their leader. He was the one who had come before mighty Pharaoh in the name of Yahweh and demanded that he let the Israelites go. He was the one who had led them away from the pursuing Egyptian army across the Red Sea to the rescue that God had prepared for them. Moses was the one who had given them God's law, ever since referred to as the law of Moses. And Moses was the one who led Israel to the borders of the promised land, blessed them, and then climbed Mount Ebal to see the promised land before he died. Thus leaving the command of God's chosen people to his assistant Joshua. And I gotta say, I think if I were in Joshua's position, I wonder if one of the things at least that I would be thinking is, I gotta follow him. Whenever a preacher moves to work with a new congregation, and the previous evangelist was a beloved one, then you always know that it's gonna go one of two ways. Either the group is very loving and they are patient and they are wise enough to embrace you and allow you to stand on your own two feet, or they may constantly be comparing you to the man you followed. And probably, since he was a great man in their eyes, you are often going to come up wanting in their estimation. It's an intimidating position to accept, following somebody of stature. But however great an evangelist a preacher may ever have to follow, they aren't having to follow Moses. Nor are they having to lead the church, like the children of Israel, into many battles to conquer lands from the Baptists or something like that. And so Joshua has some big shoes to fill, and he has quite the inherited mission to complete. And that's why God speaks to him as he does at the start of his command of Israel and his service to the Lord in that way, by saying, just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. Be strong and courageous. And he emphasizes it, only be strong and very courageous. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened. Do not be dismayed, for I am with you wherever you go. So to do what God had for him to do, Joshua was going to need genuine, pervading, defining, substantive, strong, courageous faith. And thankfully, Joshua was a man who had exhibited faith from very early on. When we first meet Joshua in Exodus chapter 17 and verse 9, he is being chosen by Moses to create an army from the men of Israel and lead them into battle against the Amalekites. Leading an army into a great battle is always a tremendous undertaking, but to do so with a brand new army of what I can only assume were untrained men against the seasoned army of Amalek would require Joshua to believe as fact nothing less than what his own name meant, Yahweh saves. And because of the faith that he possessed, verse 13 of Exodus 17 says that Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his army. And so from the moment that we meet him, Joshua is this man of faith. And because of his faith, when Joshua, as grandson of the chief of Ephraim, was chosen as the representative of his tribe that was going to go into Canaan and spy out the land, he and Caleb alone provided the two faith-filled assertions that Yahweh was more than capable of giving the land into their hands. Speaking for them both, Caleb said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." And when the people were ultimately swayed by all of the negative predictions of defeat from the 10 other spies, and when they further revolted and wanted to stone Moses and Aaron and choose new leaders for themselves and return to Egypt, it was Joshua, along with Caleb, who threw in his lot with God's leader and God's priest and said, "If the Lord delights in us, he'll bring us into the land and give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us." Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear. And as you know, because of his faith and Caleb's along with it, of all the adult Israelite males that left Egypt in the Exodus, only Joshua and Caleb actually crossed the Jordan River and entered the promised land. It's an exceedingly exclusive club that doesn't even include Moses and Aaron. But entering into that promised land is only the beginning, really, because the land still needs conquering. And so as Joshua and the people prepare to set out and take possession of the land that the Lord their God is giving them to possess, Joshua sends two spies from Shittim across the plains of Moab and the Jordan River to the city of Jericho, where they eventually come to the house of Rahab the prostitute. And if ever there was an unlikely character to be a hero of faith, it is she. We normally will search for gentle and open hearts, wounded hearts even, the ones that we think will make likely candidates to believe in God and serve His will. Prostitutes like Rahab, on the other hand, lived extremely hard lives that were filled with dishonesty and brutality and degradation. And just all-out selfish unkindness as they were selling themselves to people who only wished to use them. And so we might think it difficult for such a person to have faith in anything after a life like that. And yet from this woman's lips came these words, "Yahweh your God, He is God, in the heavens above and on the earth beneath." In other words, Yahweh is the one true God over the gods of Egypt, over the gods beyond the Jordan, and the gods of Jericho. There is nothing before Him. Yahweh is God. And so I will help you. And so when the spies come, she hides them among the stalks of flax that are drying on her roof. And when the king of Jericho hears that strange men have been seen with Rahab, he sends soldiers to inform her that they're spies and demand that she turn them over, but Rahab protects them and turns the soldiers away. And as you remember, during the night after she's procured an oath of safety and protection that she will be spared when Israel takes Jericho, which she believes they most certainly will do because of their God, she then helps the spies get out of the city by, as Joshua 2 verse 15 says, letting them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall so that she lived in the wall. And so, a few chapters after this, in chapter 6 of Joshua, Joshua and the Israelites arrive outside of Jericho, and when they come to Jericho and they find it shut up tight in full defense mode, God says to Joshua, "Behold, I have given Jericho into your hand, with its king and its mighty men of valor." And he tells him what he wants him to do. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus you shall do for 6 days. Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And on the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horns, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people shall go up, every one straight before him. I must say, out of all the military strategies that men have ever devised, I bet that there's not a single person who ever tried to come up with a plan that was anything like this. Because nobody in their right mind would expect systematic marching, trumpet blowing, and then shouting to topple the walls of a mighty city. And yet, by faith, Joshua sets the children of Israel to marching. They look like fools. But when the week is over and that final shout is loosed from them, the walls come crashing down before them, and every man goes right on up where he's standing, because the walls have turned to such rubble. Now then, with all of that said, I want to put one part of one story with another part of another. When I was growing up, when I was young, and the stories of the Old Testament were being taught to me, such as you were teaching your young people the stories of the Old Testament in your vacation Bible school, when I was learning about all the great heroes of faith and all those many stories of the victories of God for His people, for His great name, as far as the book of Joshua was concerned, there were these two stories in particular were the ones that stood out to me. I liked them the most. I liked the story of how Rahab the prostitute helped the spies of Israel by hiding them and then helping out of the city by lowering a rope through her window to the outside of the city. And I remember that that's something that only worked because, as Joshua chapter 2 makes plain, her house was built into the city wall so that she lived in the wall. And the second thing that I've always remembered is that the city of Jericho was overtaken by Israel when they followed God's 7-day plan of circumferential marching, trumpet blowing, and shouting, at the end of which, as we sing, the walls came tumbling down. And yet, even though those two stories were my favorite and those two aspects were the focus, I'm ashamed to say that it took me until just last year to make a particular connection between those two events. I imagine a number of you have come to this realization before, perhaps many years ago, but do you see the obvious connection and the apparent conflict between those two stories and two of their most crucial factors? Rahab's house was built into the walls of Jericho. That's how she's able to serve God as she does. That crucial positioning inside of the city walls, with one of the windows of her home being on the outer border of that wall. She's not built alongside of it. She's built inside of it. And yet it's the very walls of Jericho that crumble before the Israelites as God overthrows the city. Joshua chapter 6 and verse 20 says that after 7 days of marching, the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. And as soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. So the mighty walls of Jericho, easily wide enough to fit actual residences within them, fell flat before every man of Egypt, so that each of them only needed to run forward into the city to take it. And yet we know from verse 22 of chapter 6 that the portion of the wall containing Rahab's house is still standing. Because after the walls come down and Israel is beginning to attack the city, the text says, to the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, go into the prostitute's house and bring out from there the woman and all who belong to her as you swore to her. And so unless there's a part of this that I am failing to understand correctly, can you imagine what this may have looked like? Where the mighty walls of Jericho have become essentially a massive heap of stones just running as a ring around the city, but the portion of the wall that contains Rahab's house is standing up like a tower. If that's in fact how everything went down, and there's nothing within this text that I'm failing to appreciate it, how easy would it have been then
to see just what faith can do and just how strong the God of Israel truly is. At that point, how easy would it have been? But you imagine what it was like for Rahab and for her family before and during the time when those walls came crashing down around them. Last week and throughout this one, my family and I, we've been in the process of moving out of an apartment complex into a home. In that complex, we have a neighbor right on one side of us. And if that neighbor vacuums, which she does a lot, and at all hours of the day and night, when she vacuums, we hear it. When they turn on their shower, we hear it. When they click their toothbrush against the sink, we can hear that plain as day. And if they drop something that is heavy enough, we feel it. And so it stands to reason that if the rest of the apartment building were to, say, you know, collapse, we'd likely notice. So imagine then what it must have been like for Rahab and her family. How everything must have trembled like the world itself was tearing apart. And yet out of that, Rahab's house and those within it were standing at the end, saved by the one true God because of her faith. But you imagine what it took for her to have and to keep that faith. Because first of all, there is her previous lifestyle that's going against her, as we've already mentioned. Everything that she's known in life up to this point, we wouldn't think that would be very conducive to this kind of faith. Secondly, then, there is whatever lingering allegiance she may have felt toward the gods of her fathers and her people, the only gods she's ever known. And then thirdly, there is also the altogether unknown nature of this God, Yahweh, who she only knows by his deeds of power and conquest. And yet she believes in him. And she helps his spies fulfill his will. But then, of course, there's also the keeping of her faith. Because for starters, who's to say that the spies are going to keep their word? We expect that they will, because we're on the other side of this thing. But when you read their giving of their oath to her, it is extremely elaborate and very repetitive, I think, to emphasize its solemnity and their sincerity. But for all of that, in her world, the same as it is in ours, people oftentimes make oaths only to break them. Add to it, this isn't any kind of business arrangement. At stake is the life of everybody that she loves, not to mention her own. And now she has watched her city be surrounded by the forces of Israel, who everyone else thinks is the enemy. And I wonder if she asked herself during their week of marching, will they keep their promise? And I wonder if her family gave her grief for her naivete. What lengths did she perhaps have to go through to convince them to stay in the house, whereas she was claiming they would be safe? And then when the walls begin to tumble down around her and her whole world seems to be coming apart, did her faith waver then? Did she begin to think that the collapsing walls might not stop at her house after all? I don't know. This is a real woman and this is real life. How would you be? And yet when all of this is said and done, when all of those enormous clouds of dust began to settle, Rahab's house is there still standing. You imagine what that must have been like. How everything must have trembled and all those opportunities for doubt. And yet, in the end, what preservation. As we said a moment ago, it's specifically because Rahab lived in the walls that she was able to help the Israelites and serve God. It was because of that very treacherous, life-threatening situation that she was able to serve as she did. Which does make me think of one more female hero of faith, namely Esther, when she's fearing for her life. And Mordecai's trying to persuade her as queen to act to save the people of God by speaking to the king. And Esther does indeed go on to save them, but not before Mordecai points something out to her. And I imagine you remember this. This is a favorite verse of many. He says, "Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this, to serve God in this way?" As a newly minted believer of Yahweh, Rahab is surrounded by the enemy. She's also someone who had previously lived a reprehensible life. And yet, with all of that, even this prostitute was able to turn and be of great use to God and His people. God can make prostitutes into heroes among the people of God. And the strong presence of the enemies, He can turn into a pile of rubble. The only thing He requires is faith. God can do amazing things with people of faith. And so I think the story of Rahab especially, but then also, of course, Joshua, has just much to teach us about faith. From Joshua, I think we learn that when there are mighty challenges that stand before you, and God needs you to serve Him and to expand the borders of His kingdom by living the gospel and proclaiming the gospel, we need to be strong and very courageous. We need to learn that the Lord our God is with us wherever we go. 1 John chapter 5, verse 5 says, "Who is it that overcomes the world except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God?" Joshua was faithful from the moment that we met him. And then at the end of his life, he gathers all of Israel before him. And he says, "Fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and in faithfulness." He tells them, "Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord." He knows they're still kind of hanging on to that. He says, "And if it's evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, then choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And then I think from Rahab, I believe we see that when this world is crumbling around us into a heap of immorality, the children of God should be like a tower standing strong amidst the rubble. And just like Rahab, no matter what life you lived beforehand, God can make a great use out of you to fulfill His purposes if you will live by faith. And sometimes it's even because of the immense difficulties and the trying situation and the precarious position in which you may find yourself, just like with Esther and like with Rahab, that you are able to serve God. And perhaps it is that God has placed you there to specifically serve His will and to help His people. All He requires is for you to have faith. God can do amazing things with people of faith. And when all is said and done, and when this world, like Jericho, is destroyed, then the child of God, the person of faith, is still going to be standing. There will be Jacob and Rahab and all those who had faith in God still standing before the God of heaven. May we be standing with them before Him. If your faith is not what it should be, I do hope that you will choose this day to emulate the example of Joshua and Rahab. The Lord your God, as He has promised, will be with you wherever you go, but He must first be your God. And if you will confess your belief in Jesus before men, if you will repent of your sins, and follow His command to be baptized for the cleansing of your sins, then the Lord will be your God. And through Him, you, just like Jacob and Rahab, will overcome. We would love to help you choose this day whom you will serve. Won't you come while we stand and sing?